This is 4:55 on Friday, September 2nd. All right. Oh, and once again, it's cheating. All right. So it has been pointed out that although the lecture on Wednesday was recorded, I have not posted it. So I will take care of that and also take care of posting today's lecture after class, I hope. And if you don't see the lecture posted and you think and it should be normally within an hour or so of class being over, feel free to shoot me an email. And because it means I've either forgotten to do it or screwed up in doing it. And both of those things happen from time to time. All right. The Chapter 2 assignment is posted. So that's due Monday. You have both weekends. Chapter 1 is due tonight. Monday, there's no class because of the holiday. And we are in the midst of talking about the application layer, so we're going to go on doing that. Oh, before we do that, are there logistical or other questions or questions about the homework tonight? I pretty well covered it. The hard parts I thought on Wednesday, but what's up?
The diagram that's in the homework, function detail, it says to explain it to like.
Yeah. Right. So it can't be very detailed. It can't be very detailed, right?
So like MS Paint.
Yeah. Or a pen and paper and a camera. stick in the paper. Don't obsess over the process here. Okay. Colin? Okay, go. Yeah.
Oh, can transmission time and transmission delay be interchanged? Are they
yes. The transmission time, transmission delay, they're terminology that both mean the same thing.
Okay.
Yeah, that's, you know, it's really basic, but it's really important. Yeah. So great question. all right. So we're going to go on talking about the application layer. And last time, remember, we talked about client-server architecture. Oh, don't forget to sign in to Qlix. We're going to have some questions later about it, but not right now. Servers typically are associated with fixed locations, or at least fixed names. You can say www.wsu.edu, and maybe it gets translated into a different IP address at different times, but at least the name stays the same. Your laptops, on the other hand, which are attached to the WSU wireless network, every time you attach, it's very likely you get a different IP address, and often the IP address you get isn't even one that could be gotten to by somebody outside unless you did something to make to do that. So, so that's the characteristic of clients. And given all of that, the behavior is that the clients have to contact the servers first. That's the look at that. You don't get to see it, but I have a pop-up on my screen that says we're ready to install some updates. No. Thanks a bunch, Bill.
You set that up for 1:30 in the morning 2 days ago.
I did. And now there's more.
Oh, my God.
Not that I'm monitoring.
No, but...
No, we did watch you do that, though.
You know that I did that. So then there's the button that I want to, you know, their new interface doesn't have a confirmation that I have done this. Instead, there's a button that says restart now that could just totally disrupt the class for the next 10 minutes. So, all right. I have to have some place to rant, you know, so...
Appreciative of the choir.
Right? Yeah, well, we all ran together. All right, and then we talked about peer-to-peer, this very silly pun that uses the two in the middle, in which
in which perhaps there is no server, or the server is only involved minimally, and then the clients talk to each other. Often you need a server in order to help the clients just find each other, right? Because they move around. All right. So now we've talked about the way it works for the hosts, but remember that when we have communication going on at the application layer, it's really between processes or programs running on the host and not the hosts themselves. The application protocol, the applications are processes. And if we have more than one process running on a machine at a time, how are we going to tell which one is trying to communicate? Well, we need some way to address them. And in order to address processes, we use... Sorry, I'm going to skip over that one for a second. In order to address a process, we have to have an identifier for a process. And the identifier for the host, at least using IP version 4, is a 32-bit number, and we'll talk about that in the network layer. But what do we do to address the processes within the host? Well, we use something called a port number. So in the... If you look at your clicks screen, you'll see that the address that I've given you for the clicks for this class is clicks.eecs.wsu.edu. That translates to an IP address. And then a colon and 7070. And in the 7070 there is the port number. Okay? So port numbers are 16-bit numbers. And some of the port numbers are sort of small numbers, like 80 for HTTP and 25 for SMTP and 443 for SMTP with security and stuff like that. Those small numbers, well, they're not always small, but those numbers that you often see are called well-known port numbers. That means that it's very typical to find a web server on port 80, a mail server on port 25, a secure mail server on port 443. But really, the numbers can be anything at all, right? And so for clicks, the port number is 7070. Even though it's a web server, it uses port number 77. And we'll come back to that, all right, to that part.
Now I'm going to go backwards in the notes. And say that
I've just lied to you. Port numbers are not associated with processes. Port numbers are associated with something in the operating system called sockets. And sockets are associated with processes. Okay? So mostly this distinction doesn't matter, but I might as well just be accurate about it. So the way a process works is that it creates a socket, which is just really a data structure within the operating system, along with a reference to it, creates a socket, and then uses the socket operating system calls to do various things to the socket. And when we get to socket programming at the end of next week, we'll talk about what those things are that a process does to a socket. And some of you in 360 may have already done a bit of this. But from the perspective of the code that's the application running in this process, it is interacting with this operating system level thing called a socket. And when it does, operating system, through the transport layer, the network layer, the link layer, and the physical layer, which are all implemented by the operating system and the hardware, is carrying out the communication that the process wants to do. Questions about this? This is a little bit abstract, and this diagram is not terribly illuminating about this, But just realize that a socket is an operating system level concept. It's not the same thing as a port. The process is going to do system calls that associate the socket with a port number. But a port number is just a number, right? It's just 16 bits. In order to represent that within an operating system, you need a bunch more data, and that's what this socket data structure is all about. In Unix-y systems, sockets are represented within the application processes as just small integers, like file descriptors are in Unix. And in Windows-y systems, sockets are represented by handles, which are great big numbers that within the operating system get translated to the associated data structure, either way. Okay. Any questions about this?
So we did the addressing part. All right.
So given that we have a socket, we're going to run the application level protocol by sending and receiving messages on that socket. And what are the types of messages? Well, it depends on the application. In the case of the web, it might be a request response. In the case of mail, it might be, here's a list of recipients. Please deliver this message to those recipients. So the protocol, in some sense, an app layer protocol is just like any other protocol. It defines the types of messages that can be exchanged, what their syntax is, what they mean, and what the rules are for when you're supposed to send a message, a particular kind of message. Some application protocols are what are called open protocols. They're defined in public documents. And so we'll be saying these words multiple times during the class. Many of them are defined in what are called the Internet RFCs. And that's a three-letter acronym you need to become familiar with. RFC here stands for Request for Comments. It's a complete misnomer because by the time a protocol is standard, it's no longer a request for comments, it's a standard, right? It's no longer an actual request for comments. If they're not wanting comments anymore, that's the answer. But that's the name that got adopted way back when, and that's what they're still called. There are about probably upwards of 7,000 of them now. Some of them really were requests for comments, and other ones have turned into standards. You can look this up on the web and find the repository for all of the RFCs, and if you do a lot of networking, you'll start to speak in RFC numbers for different protocols. But I don't do enough networking to do that, but there are people who do. That's one source of open protocols. Another source of open protocols is the World Wide Web Consortium, the W3C. And from the W3C, I think you will find that's where standards for things like what is the layout of an HTML document comes from. I think HTTP is actually even though it's web-related, is actually in that RFC. Okay? So those are what are called open protocols, and then there are proprietary protocols. Example would be Skype, right? There's nobody who's able to implement a third-party client for Skype because the Skype folks have not really revealed all the details about what happens in their protocol. Other ones, the video conferencing protocol for Polycom, video conference machines, certain internet telephony providers use proprietary protocols. But there's a lot of leverage in having open protocols because you get a lot of people interested in implementing things. All right, so that's what the protocol is.
The next question we need to ask ourselves is, if we look back at this picture
and think about what this picture means, it says that the application process is making use of the services provided by the transport layer. That's the application's view of what the network is. Okay? So we'll ask ourselves, services should the transport layer be provided to the application layer? Later, we'll ask, what services does the network provide to the transport, and so forth. But right now, what is the application depending upon from the transport layer? And that's where we want to go. Okay, so let's see what some of these things are. Data integrity. Some applications, like file transfer and browsing the web, you darn well want to make sure that every byte you send for a web page arrives at the web browser in the same order that it was sent. Right? If not, what do we get? Garbled web pages. On the other hand, something like audio, just talking, the human ear is pretty good at filling in gaps. So if we drop a packet out of an audio stream from time to time, maybe that's not so bad. On the other hand, if we do the things necessary to have 100% reliable data transfer for our audio stream, we may run afoul of something else that the human ear is really bothered by, which would be gaps in the conversation. Because if we've dropped some data out of an audio stream and we have to get it before we can go on, we have to wait for it. And that's really annoying to the human ear. So it might be better to just not have that data than it would be to wait for it. Okay, some applications, like talking on the telephone, or telephony, the amount of delay between the time I talk and you hear me, we don't usually think about as being an issue. But have you ever talked over a conversation, over a link, where the delay was sort of upward of a quarter second? Really, really annoying, right? And so we know, therefore, that the amount of delay in some applications really matters. On the other hand, the amount of delay when I'm just sending an email message doesn't particularly matter so much. Unless it sort of extends to the point that my mail client sits there with a window up on the screen saying, sending, and it lasts for far longer than I think it should, and then I get worried about whether it's really doing it at all, right? But the actual transmission of the data, if we're transmitting the data, we don't usually worry about it too much. Some things, the speed at which the data gets transferred matters. And again, video here is the prime example. You know, we didn't have Netflix 15 years ago. Did we have Netflix 10 years ago? I don't know, somewhere around there. It started to be possible that the internet was fast enough to transfer the amount of data needed for video. But on the other hand, we could do the web long before that. And of course, security. And we'll have a lot to say about security later. So we can put these into a table, thinking about what we require. Folks who play interactive games, I think this table is way out of date, right? Interactive games these days, you don't want to wait several seconds for knowing what your competitor is doing, right? I mean, in the reading I've been doing, where people are sort of worrying about sort of how long it takes them to hit a key,
this suggests that, you know, whether the difference between winning and losing is the response of the keyboard, I don't think a few seconds of delay will do.
But, you know, things change. All right. So, to support our applications with these different needs, the internet protocols, the internet transport protocols, come in two flavors. Well, two basic flavors and then other ones that don't get used so much. The so-called TCP service, so there's another three-letter acronym, another TLA. TCP standing for Transmission Control Protocol. TCP is a reliable transport protocol. It delivers the bytes that are sent from the sender to the receiver in the same order that they were sent. And if it can't do that, then it considers its the connection to be broken. Right? So if you reach a point with TCP that it can't get the very next byte, it will say, no more, we're done, it's broken, right? You have to start over again, say. That's what we mean by reliable transport. There's no way to be reliable beyond that point, right? If you can't get the next point, there's no way to be reliable beyond the point where it has dropped something, because the rule is it has to deliver. Flow control, in support of reliable delivery, one of the things that TCP does is it has a mechanism in there for the receiver to tell the sender to slow down. Okay. That's the flow control piece. It has congestion control, which is a way for the network to tell the sender to slow down. Those are two different things, and when we look at TCP, we'll study how that works. But on the other hand, it doesn't provide any minimum throughput, doesn't provide any security, doesn't provide any latency or delay guarantees. It just does what is called best effort on those regards. And finally, in order to do all of these things, TCP is called a connection-oriented model. Now, the connection here is a connection between the sender and receiver. It has nothing to do with the network. The network, you know, when we talked about circuit-switched models, we talked about connections through the network. Here, we're just talking about sort of a logical abstraction that says, I, sender, am connected to you, receiver, and the network doesn't care. But that comes with a cost. Okay, so that's TCP. The other three-letter acronym for transport protocols of the internet is UDP. It stands for User Datagram Protocol. It's unreliable data transfer. A sender sends a message, and it may or may not be delivered to the receiver. It doesn't care. Okay? The reason it works is because the internet is pretty darn good at delivering data. So, you know, 99.99% of the time you send a UDP message, and if things are working as they should be in the internet, it will be delivered. Maybe even more than that. But nevertheless, the protocol itself makes no attempt to recover from missing messages. It doesn't do flow control, congestion control, timing, throughput, security, etc. So you might ask, why is there a UDP? And given what I've told you, you ought to be able to answer that question. So why is there a UDP? I've already told you enough information that you can tell me the answer. Somebody want to take a flyer at that one? Sure, Keon. Yeah.
Is it just because they're reliable enough that if you miss a few packets?
Well, that would be, it's okay to have a UDP, but why do we need a UDP?
Yeah. I don't really know why, but like, I don't think any of we're doing my UDP connections, and it didn't really mean to like stream a lot of stuff. It just needed a whole from the drums and back up information.
Okay. So this connection-oriented piece is one clue here in TCP. With TCP, because I have to make a connection before I can send any data, I have to suffer a round-trip time before I can send data on a TCP. That's one reason. What's another reason? And really it has to do with problems of TCP rather than any features of UDP that we need UDP. So anybody have any other clues? Well, when I talked about voice and the human ear and how it would be disrupted by having to wait for something as opposed to something being dropped, TCP delivers everything in order. If something is dropped, it's going to have to wait. Whereas UDP, if something is dropped, it just gets dropped and we go on. So both of those are reasons that the faster communication to begin with, because we don't need time for a connection, and the fact that sometimes waiting for data to arrive is worse than just having it not arrive and going on, both justify the need for UDP. TCP alone would not be a good solution. Okay, so transport protocols do different applications use? You see all of the ones where the reliability matters are going to use TCP. The ones where it may be better to give up on getting something rather than getting it reliably may use UDP. Another one here that is not listed is the domain name service. That's the thing that looks up www.wsu.edu and gives you back the IP address. That often will use DNS as well because we can ask a question, get an answer back in the time that it would otherwise take to set up a connection for TCP. So depends on what you need, which one you should use. How about security? Neither TCP nor UDP provides any form of security. And in particular, if you type in your password to something that is running over just plain TCP or UDP, that password is going to appear on the network. So remember last time I did my rant about FTP. That's exactly the problem, FTP. Typically, you want to have some protection of the files that you're retrieving or storing, and FTP doesn't provide that. So to augment TCP, there's another protocol. It's actually implement the application layer, but it acts like a transport protocol, so it sort of sits in between the application layer and the real transport protocol. It's called TLS. It was formerly known as SSL, and one of my colleagues says if you're still calling it SSL, you're showing your ignorance. So it's TLS, transport layer security, and it provides encryption over a TCP connection, but then offers an interface that otherwise looks very much like TCP. It provides data integrity, authentication, lives at the op layer, and yeah. So we'll talk about TLS when we get to chapter 7. All right,
TLS used on HTTPS?
HTTPS is built over top of TLS, yeah.
Does UDP have any encryption standard?
There's actually something called DTLS, Datagram TLS, that's much newer than TLS. Doesn't seem to see a lot of use yet, but it certainly is promising. We've been, in some of our research, we've been looking at using
DTLS for something that's otherwise a UDP-based protocol. All right. Other questions about sort of the background here? And then we'll dive into the web and HTTP. Oh, the form of that question was, is HTTPS implemented over TLS? So HTTPS is not really a protocol in and of itself. It stands for HTTP plus TLS. Or it really stands for HTTP secure in the naming space, but it's not really a separate protocol. Okay, so let's talk about the web application protocol. So a web page terminology, a web page that you typically see today consists of multiple objects. We're going to call them objects. They're not programming objects. They're sort of English language objects. And the web page, as you see it, has many objects in it. One of those objects is the base file that may refer to other files. So, neither the class web page nor Qlix is a good example of this. But if you go to much any web page like EECS or WSUs, and look at the source for the web page, which you can do using Control U. So why don't we just do that? That would be a good idea. Pick a browser. Debating whether to use my own or use, since I know my own, we'll use my own rather than the classes. So that's what it looks like. And if we look at the source, which you can do with Control U, you'll see the HTML text that makes up this web page. And within that page, you will see things with these href fields in them. And those href fields refer to other things that are needed in order to display this web page. So one thing that you need to display this web page is a style sheet called style.css. Another thing that you may need is these images. They have a source field in them. So you need to get these two images in order to display that web page. These hrefs are just links that are going to show up, so we don't actually retrieve these until somebody clicks on them. But mostly, I would say the resources that are the objects that make up this web page are the main page, the style sheet, and the two images. Okay. Those are the objects in this web page. Okay, and each of those objects is referenced by what's called another three-letter acronym, a URL, a Uniform Resource Locator. URL. And what does a URL consist of? Well, in its completely general form, it consists of a host name and a path on that host name, and perhaps some additional data fields, which we'll talk about later. It turns out that if the resources are on the same server where the main page came from, we can use a relative path, which means that it doesn't have the host name that it starts with. It doesn't have the host name and just has the location on the server. So we make a request and we get a response. It's a client server protocol.
So the client has to know where the server is. It can then make a request and get back a response.
How exciting. Okay. It's built over TCP. The HTTP protocol is built over TCP. And what is HTTP? It's not the same thing as the content of the web page, right? Content of the web page is that text that I showed you before, and that text is written in a language called HTML or XML. HTTP is the networking protocol that's been defined for clients to retrieve things from web servers. Client initiates TCP connection using, by default, port 80. The well-known port for the web is port 80. The server accepts that connection, and then the client starts sending messages at the application protocol in order to retrieve the web pages or to store pages. Web servers can store pages. And once we're all done, it closes. Now, here's an important term. HTTP is what is called a stateless protocol. That means that the client makes a request, the server responds, and there's nothing about the protocol itself that requires the server to remember anything about what the client has done up to this point. It can just make a request and get a response. Make another request, get another response. It doesn't have to. This is unlike FTP or SSH or a lot of other protocols that do require the server to remember, the server and the client both, to remember what has gone before they can properly behave according to the protocol. HTTP came about in the very early days of the network, around 1991, I think. The folks that invented the World Wide Web came up with the first version of this. And they weren't really networking people. They weren't really confident about some of these things having to do with state. And they just said it would be so much simpler if it were stateless. And so that's what they did. The kinds of problems that arise if one of them crashes, their views of the state may be inconsistent, must be reconciled. Okay. Simplicity here was valued. Another protocol that is stateless is the network file system protocol that was invented by Sun and is used a lot between Unix machines and file servers. It's also a stateless protocol. Stateless is not a panacea. It certainly brings problems of its own, and state is sometimes a necessary component of what you want to do, and if you have a stateless protocol, you then have to go off and invent it at yet a higher layer, right? Yeah. So the Microsoft file sharing protocol is not stateless. It is very stateful. It's a lot more complicated than in that. So we'll talk more about that. And we're going to see that even in the web server world, we need state, and we have to reinvent it at a slightly higher layer. Okay, originally HTTP was defined in such a way that you made one request over a connection and got back the answer and closed the connection. And then you went on and if you wanted the next thing off a page, made another connection, got another answer. People realized this was unnecessarily slow and not hard to fix. And soon invented what's called persistent HTTP, which says I open a connection, I make a request, I get back the answer, I make another request on the same connection, and I make another request and another request, and I don't even have to wait for the answers to the second and subsequent requests before making the next one. So I can just send a whole bunch of requests and then get back the answers. What problems arise
in doing that? Well, one of the issues could be that the server may actually answer the questions in a different order than you ask them, right? Which means that part of the protocol would have to be some mechanism for the client to associate an answer with a particular question. I think in HTTP that's not the case. I think the server does answer in the order they were requested, but it could be. I mean, it's an issue we'd have to think about in defining this.
So it's a performance issue. Went the wrong direction. So here's a picture.
So, you know, we haven't really talked about how TCP works yet. I've said a couple of times, you have to make a connection. And in order to make a connection with TCP, you first go through this little dance where you say, I want to make a connection, and the server says, okay, let's talk. And that takes a whole round trip time.
And then the,
having done that, I want to talk, let's talk. Then I can make my actual request. And
get back the answer. So we've waited two round trip times. Now, this diagram is great. I'm going to point out something. We're going to use diagrams that look like this a lot in this class. And there's a bit of graphical language here to get. The two sides of the diagram are separated in space. We have the client on the left and the server on the right. So they're some distance apart. And this dimension is time. So when I say, if you look at this red arrow, what does it mean? It means I send something at this point in time and space, and at a later time and at a different point in space, I receive it, and vice versa. So when we say, when we look at one of these diagrams, we can say, well, how long did it take for this request to happen? It took this amount of time. Okay?
Just get used to it, because we're going to look at a lot of those diagrams, and sometimes it will be more or less clear that that's the kind of diagram it is. So
we'll just keep doing it until it becomes second nature. And then finally, after we've got that one thing, we close the connection. Now, and so we have to do that for each of the objects that make up the page. Now, if we have persistent HTTP, what bugs me about this is that there's no slide in here that corresponds to what happens with persistent HTTP. So I guess I have to draw one. And once I do that, we'll probably be done for the day. So. Okay, so here's persistent HTTP. And we're not going to get to any clicks questions today. We'll save them for next time and consider them review. Okay, so here's our client and our server. This is our TCP connect and our TCP OK. And here's our main page request. And main page response. All right, so that part is still the same as it was before, because the client doesn't know what it's supposed to do before it gets the actual main page. But once it has the main page, what does it do? It says image 1, Image 2, these are the requests for these things. Image 3, because it's read the page and seen what the objects are that it needs to get. And then, unfortunately, and then the server gets those, and depending on how big they are, sends them right back. So you see that this is much less time than it would have taken before, because in the non-persistent case, we would have had to do a connect and a two-round trip time for every one of those things. And here, it's one round trip time plus the transmission time for all the data that we're going to get. Okay? So that's persistent versus non-persistent HTTP. Any questions? Next time, we're going to go into what is the data that is sent in this protocol. What exactly is the data? You're going to need that to understand what makes up a text-level protocol, and also you'll need it later. Gentlemen, I am not finished. I am still talking, right? Thank you. And you're going to need it for the last project, where one of the things that you're going to do is implement something that actually reads HTTP requests, forwards them to another server, gets back the answer, and forwards it to the client. That's called a proxy server. And another thing we'll talk about next time is why you might want to have a proxy server. But so I'm telling you what you're going to have to do, but I'm not going to tell you why you have to do it today. I'll save that until next time. Okay, now I'm finished. Monday is a holiday, so I will see you on Wednesday. If you don't see web pages or videos and audio files by later this afternoon, let me know.